That's like introducing my very best friend, as a friend of ours said one night, introducing Bill, and he said, "Oh, now I'll give you Charles." I'm glad the chairman told you my name, because I've forgotten it. My name is Aurelia Wallace, and as Nancy said, I am the recovering wife of a recovering alcoholic. And I come here well instructed. If you all do not get anything out of this talk, at least I cannot take the blame. I don't have to take the blame, because I come well instructed. My husband gave me instructions to get back to my room and go over my talk that he had prepared for me. And all of my other friends that I passed in the hall, they all gave me little bits to say, like I rode down here with Bud and Laverne and Joe and Dorothy, and don't forget to mention my name, you know, and all this. So if I don't say anything to help you, it isn't my fault. No, seriously, I'm not nervous at all. Like, when I talked in Canada, I found myself trying to unlock my door with my pencil. And I forgot, well instructed to wear my badge, and I forgot my badge this morning. And also, one time, they gave me very strict instructions at this particular meeting not to use my last name. And I immediately got up and said, "My name is Aurelia Wallace." So I'm not nervous, just bear with me. But seriously, if my heart could speak, this message would be certainly an inspiration and a masterpiece. But since my little old heart has to transmit through my little old brain, why, you all have to do the piecing together yourself. And if I leave you hanging in midair, why, see me after the meeting and I'll try to fill you in. My story is not dramatic at all, because before Al-Anon, I wouldn't have gotten up in front of two people and said my name. I was never in a school play. I was never in anything that I might be out in front. I would never even join a PTA, because I was afraid I would have to get up and say my name or have to walk down the aisle in front of people. So this, if Al-Anon has done nothing else for me, it has given me the courage to at least get up here and try to give you a message. My story is not spectacular only to me, in that it is one miracle after another. It is a series of miracles, believe me. I can't begin to tell you what Al-Anon has done for me in 3 days, let alone 1 hour. I think the first thing that comes to my mind is that it has kept me out of an insane institution, as someone said, a state-supported institution, because we would never have been able, or still are not able, to afford what we call our country club on the hill, Our Lady of Peace Hospital as such. But I'm sure that without Al-Anon, that I would be a vegetable in one of these institutions. And it has also prevented the second divorce in our family. This I'm sure of. Our program suggests that we, too, try to tell what we were like before, what we were like during, and what we're trying to do now. It also tells us that we are not to tell our husband's story, but since he wrote mine, maybe he'll have a few choice bits in it that I'm not supposed to say. But nevertheless, if I do bring him into it, it certainly isn't in a derogatory manner. It is only to show you my reaction to this disease or to this problem. As a child, I had most of my defects of character, I have found out since Al-Anon. In fact, I think I had all of them. Alcoholism might have magnified some of them, but it certainly didn't cause them. I had fears as a child. I was always a worrywart. Even I remember my mother telling me that I manufactured worries. I didn't borrow them like most people. I manufactured them. I can remember coming home from school, the nuns telling us about an uprising in China or some such thing, and I would come home at night and go to sleep, and I would awaken. I could see the Chinese coming in the window to cut my head off and all this sort of thing. And I can remember them talking about hard times, and I would worry myself to death. I would go to school and save my lunch money because I thought they were going to need it for groceries that night. And I was always worrying about something. I was a very determined child. I always got my way, some way or somehow, by hook or crook. I always managed to get my own way. And I always thought my determination was a virtue. But I found out in Al-Anon that it is not always. Anything overdone is not a virtue, and I certainly overdid this determination. I can remember, when I was about 10 or 11 years old, I learned to sew because my parents couldn't afford to buy me the kind of clothes that I wanted. I did my own ironing when I was about 11 years old because mother couldn't iron to suit me. And I used to set people's hair in my home to make money to buy the things that I wanted that they couldn't or didn't think necessary for me, maybe. And I was reported by the Kentucky Beauticians Association for practicing without a license. So I managed to do anything and everything that I set my mind to do. And I was always trying to be something that I wasn't. I was always reaching for something. Anything anyone else could do, I could do, or I could do better. And I was always reaching for something. And through Al-Anon, I have found out that I can be me. And this has been wonderful. And I still have to fight all these little defects of character. I haven't mastered them by any means, but through Al-Anon, I have learned to live with them and have learned to work on them, and life has become much, much easier. I think I could have had an extremely happy childhood if it had not been for these defects of character. My family were poor, but as my dad always said, proud, and we always had the necessities of life and maybe a few luxuries, more luxuries than we absolutely needed, I suppose. But we were poor, but proud, and we were a happy family. We were a very, very close family. There was always love and consideration and understanding in our home. And my father was quite a bit older than my mother, and he babied all of us. We were all spoiled. I'm the oldest of three. There were 6 years difference between my sister and my brother and I. And he spoiled all of us. I don't think he ever went out of the house that he didn't take one or all three of us with him if we wanted to go. He liked to work around the house. During the Depression, when he was home a lot, he helped mother with the housework. We used to call him our big old country boy. He went to bed with the chickens and he got up with the chickens. And he worked in the yard in the mornings and before he would go to work, and our yard looked like a florist shop. And he would come in and fix breakfast. I don't ever remember my mother getting up to cook breakfast. He would fry meat and fry potatoes and make hot biscuits, and he would have it all on the table, and he would call my mother down and have a pan of warm water on the stove for her to wash her face in. And I thought all husbands were like this. I'm not going to tell you I was disappointed. But he was what they both were, what I like to think of as nearly perfect as any two humans could be. And my mother was equally as good. She saw to it that we had good clothes to wear to school. She saw to it that we had our homework at night. She'd sit around the table with us and help us get our homework. And she would let us have plays, and she would let us make doll clothes and help us do all these things. She was always willing to get along on my dad's salary. She never bothered her what the neighbors had. She was always happy with what she had and made the best of it. They never went in debt for anything in their lifetime. They never, ever bought one thing on time. Now, it never occurred to me that all wives should be like my mother either, but because I certainly didn't start out that way. Bill and I married, and I was 17 and he was 24. He doesn't always remember those dates. He gets them mixed up. He He's gotten so now when he talks, he'll always say, we married in certain date, and then he'll look out to see if I'm shaking my hand. So, see, I still have a long way to go in this program. But anyway, I think our first year was what I would like to think of as a normal, happy year. He drank, and I knew he drank when I married him. But this was fun. This was something different for me because I had never tasted alcohol until I married him. There had never been any alcohol in our family. I think I had one uncle whom we might call an alcoholic. We were afraid of him, and we didn't go around him very much. But I think if there had been a bottle of liquor, or still yet today, a bottle of liquor in my home or in our home, and my mother couldn't get it out any other way other than burn the house down, she'd set the house on fire to get rid of that bottle of whiskey. So I knew nothing about alcohol. And when I started dating Bill, this was something new to me. He was a lot of fun, and I think the night I met him, he was drinking a bottle of beer. And he was a little older than the crowd I'd run around with, and he was just, I fell in love with him, love at first sight. He was just what I needed. And I think first two or three dates we went out in the crowd that I had was running around with, and this didn't appeal to him, so he invited me to go out in the crowd with him. And this night we went to one of these places where you knock on the door and they slide a little panel back and look out and see who you are and then let you in. And this is where I had my first taste of alcohol, and I liked it. I drank a gin buck, and I shall never forget it. I've never tasted one like it since either. But this was fun for me. It was something that I wasn't used to. Forbidden fruit, I guess. And I was the type of person that I was sheltered. I always run home and told Mother wherever I'd been, what I'd done, what kind of time I'd had, and all this and all that. But the night that I went to this little place with Bill, I certainly didn't go home and tell Mama where I'd been, because I knew that they would forbid me to see Bill again. And I didn't want this to happen. So we dated for about a year before we married, and I think I saw him was too much to drink on several occasions, maybe two or three times, but I had no idea that it would be a problem or that it even could be a problem. I thought that, well, when we get married, he won't drink too much ever. My family, we always stayed home. They never went anywhere, really, unless the whole family went out together, so I thought there was no other way of life. And I think the first year that we were married, I went with him most of the time, and then we had a little boy, and when this little boy came along, well, I felt like I couldn't go then. I had to stay home with him. And about this time, I think he began staying out a little more and spending a little more money on drinking, and this is when my part of the disease began to set in, because this is when I started nagging. I can remember the night I come home from the hospital with our son. The boys he worked with gave a party for him to celebrate the birth of the son, and he come home about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and his necktie was cut in two, and his shirt was torn off. And I can remember going into a rage over this. I remember telling him exactly how much that necktie cost and how much that shirt cost and how much money we had, how little money we had, and I suppose the rest of the night. And from then on, my nagging pattern set in, and his drinking pattern set in. As you all know, this grew steadily worse, and little by little, day by day, he stayed out, spent more money, finally got to the point where maybe it would be 2 or 3 days before he'd come home. And I would walk the floor, scream and cry and beg and pray and do all these things. And by the time he did come home, why, I was ready for him. And boy, I'd let him have it. I remember one time him telling me, in our home, heck was a dirty word. We didn't say dern, we didn't say heck. Mother would say, you might as well say hell as to say heck. Or you might as well say damn. And so we never used those kind of words. And I can remember Bill making a remark one time that there was one word or one phrase that no one was ever going to call him and get by with it, and it was SOB. So, boy, from then on, every time he'd come in the house, he was a dirty SOB. And I learned a lot of words that I didn't know before, believe me, and I used them fluently. But by the time our son was 4 years old, I found out I was pregnant again. Oh, getting ahead of my story. In the meantime, I told you about my worry pattern. Why Bill, as I said, was drinking quite a bit and spending a lot of money and making less. He had gone to work for a funeral home. And believe you me, this is an alcoholic's paradise. And he wasn't making very much money, but he had all the reasons in the world and all the excuses for staying out late and not coming home. And he'd come in and tell me, oh, we had 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, we had a dead call. And of course, I would go out and get the morning paper, and I'd come back in and look over the paper, and I wouldn't see any notice in the paper. And he'd say, well, it was a ship out. They had the veterans contract, and it was a ship out. And he always had all these excuses. So this was an alcoholic's paradise. And he wasn't making, or he wasn't bringing, I don't know how much money he was making, but he wasn't bringing much money home, let's put it that way. And I began to worry about sending this child through college. And here he was, 2 years old, maybe 3 years old, and I was just, I had to go to work. I just had to go to work. So I did, and I never ever let Bill forget why I went to work. It was because we wouldn't have enough to eat if I didn't work. We wouldn't have clothes to wear if I didn't work. And here I was going out, leaving this poor child so that I could help make the living for him, and he didn't appreciate it enough to even come home and stay home with me. So anyway, when Bill Jr. was about 4 years old, I found out I was pregnant again. And man, this really upset me, because I knew now we'd starve to death, because it was taking every cent I made to live on. And I could just see our little emaciated bodies. I knew that this was going to be it. So I had already started the pattern of prayer. I had started running to church every time church bell rang. And the priest in our parish had finally gotten to the point, had gotten to the point long before I did, to where they, we would see the bill collectors come up the walk, we'd run, close the blinds or lock the door, and we wouldn't answer the telephone. And our priest got to this point long before I did, because when he'd see me coming up the walk, I think he'd pull the blinds down and pretend he wasn't home, because I was always running to him, telling him what Bill was doing to me, and will you please say prayers for him, and wave your magic wand and sober him up. So when I found out that I was going to have to quit work, I think I decided then that I would change my pattern of prayer. I thought, well, now maybe this is what we need. If we have a little boy and with another child, he'll have more responsibility, and maybe this will be exactly what we need. So I decided I wanted a little girl. So then I started my pattern of prayer for a little girl. And shortly before, of course, he hadn't changed his pattern any, of course, and I expected him to, and I kept reminding him of his duties at home and so forth and so on. And I was walking the floor, and I'd cry, and I'd scream, and please, God, bring him home. Please don't let anything happen to him. And then when I'd see him stagger up the street, I'd say, oh, dear God, not drunk. Why didn't you let him get killed? And I'd even gotten to the point by this time where I was planning on spending. I knew he was going to get killed, because you just didn't run around and stay out all night and do all these things and survive it, I didn't think. Anyway, I had even thought about collecting double indemnity on his insurance. This is one thing I kept paid up with, his insurance. And so shortly before this child was born, he was out on a fishing trip. And this is something he never did in his life. I don't think he ever went fishing in his lifetime. I'm sure he didn't. But one of his excuses to get out of the house. And while he was gone, or I didn't have any idea how long he was going to be gone. I never did by this time. But anyway, a man came to our door and knocked on the door. And when I answered it, he was standing there with a gun. And he was going to kill Bill. And I told him I had no idea when Bill would be home. that sometimes he was gone an hour and sometimes a day and sometimes 2 or 3 days. And he said it didn't matter, that he would come in and wait for him. So there wasn't anything else for me to do but let him in with that gun in his hand. And like all alcoholics, he did the obvious thing. He came home on time. And when I heard his footsteps around the walk, I went all to pieces. And I don't think that the thought of his murder upset me too much by this time, because this would relieve the problem. But I didn't want to witness it. And so, like, you know how cunning they are. And he talked the man out of it and told... He told the man, or convinced the man, that he wasn't guilty of whatever he was accusing him of. And believe you me, I had mixed emotions over this. I really did. Like I said, I didn't want to witness it, but yet I thought this would relieve my problem. But shortly after this, this child was born, and it was a little girl, and she was exactly what I had prayed for. And I thought, well, this, all my prayers will be answered. I know this will be it. And I couldn't wait to get her home from the hospital. And in those days, you stayed in 9, 10, 12 days. And I couldn't wait for the time to bring her home, because I knew that this was going to be a whole new world for us, a new life for us. Now, why I thought this, I don't know, because he did come to see me on occasion while I was there. And he'd stay 15 or 20 minutes, and out he'd go. And I was hearing all kinds of rumors about the big time he'd had the night before, you know. But yet I thought, well, he is out celebrating, you know. This is his last fling, and he is going to settle down. So I brought her home the day I was to bring her home from the hospital. They told me that she might not live, and if she did, she would be a hopeless cripple. And this upset me no end. And, you know, I immediately began blaming him for this child being in this condition. I knew it was his fault. If he hadn't put me through all this, this wouldn't have happened. And as the saying goes, you can't see the forest for the trees. I didn't stop to think that there were many, many other children born in this condition, or even worse than she was, into what we call normal, happy homes, whatever a normal home is. But I couldn't see this. The only thing I could see was it was his fault, that it couldn't be my fault. I had to blame him for her being in this condition. She lived 3 months and died. And from then on, this old resentment just kept eating away at me. I was in Al-Anon a long time before I became aware of the fact that I was carrying this resentment. I could see kids, oh, when they were starting in school, little girls, and then on up, I could graduating and getting married and all for years and years. And I could picture our little girl, and I could still blame him for it. And this is the program at work, the inventory step. Each step is important to me, but I think some of them stand out in our mind a little more than others. And the inventory step is so very important to me, because through this, I realized that I was carrying this resentment. I haven't been able to take an inventory like most people do. This is an individual program. We work it the way it suits us best. And I have tried. When I first started trying to take an inventory, I became so depressed, I couldn't stand it. I finally decided to give up. And someone told me that I wasn't taking it the right way, that I was taking all the bad and wasn't looking for anything good, and that I should try to balance it out. And when I got to the point where I couldn't find something good to go along with something bad, then quit for the time being. So this is the way I work my inventory step. And I am so grateful that I was able to work it this way. If all of these defects of character come to the surface at one time, I'd jump off the Kennedy Bridge, believe me. But by taking a daily inventory and becoming aware of these things gradually, each day I become aware of some new defect of character that I can work on. And this has worked beautifully for me. And this is what happened in this case. I was in Al-Anon for years before I became aware that I was still carrying this resentment about this little girl toward Bill. And I began to work on it, and my attitude, my opinions, and my love changed for him from that day on. About this time, I think that, my part of the disease was progressing more rapidly than his. His was progressing rapidly enough, but mine was progressing more rapidly than his. And I was getting to the point where I wouldn't go anywhere. I wouldn't even go to the grocery store because I didn't want to see people. I didn't want people asking me where he was or how he was or anything about our lives at all. And I had gotten to the point where I didn't want to go to church anymore because I envied people in church, couples together. I envied couples out shopping together. And I don't know why families of alcoholics always have to move next door to people, to families where the man takes out the garbage and washes the windows and plays ball with the kids and all this sort of thing. I resented everybody and everything. And I finally decided that I couldn't live like this anymore. This is not the kind of a life I was used to. I was taught that any man who stayed out late at night and didn't come home and take care of his family like he was supposed to was up to no good at all. They weren't just out drinking. And this I believed. And I reminded him of it continuously, too. Believe me, if there was anything in the book that he didn't do, it wasn't because he wasn't told about it. It wasn't because he was ignorant of it, because I told him and accused him of everything in the book. And by this time, I decided that I couldn't live the rest of my life like this, and I was going to get a divorce. So I called his cousin, had married us, and when he married us, he was a newly ordained priest, and he and Bill were very, very close as young boys. They had grown up together, and Bill had promised him that he could marry him whenever he married. So our wedding was his first wedding after his ordination. And as Bill says, he wasn't proud of us, but he was proud of the marriage. But I'm sure by this time that he was pretty much disgusted with us because I had worn him out also. In fact, I helped drive him to an early grave. But I called him one night and told him that I didn't intend to live like this. We had separated I don't know how many times. I was always running back home to Mother, and as Bill says, we never did put anything up too high because one or the other of us was always leaving. And usually it was me. But I decided that this was going to be once and for all. That I used to tell him all the time that whenever I really make up my mind to divorce you, why then you know I'm gone for good. Don't you ever even try to get me back. So I had made up my mind that this was the time. So I called Father Lehman and I told him that I was going to divorce him. And so he asked me not to, of course, and he asked us to go back together and buy a little house across the street from his church, and he would keep his eye on Bill and he would keep him sober. Now, this man was a very learned man. He had studied in Austria and he was ordained in Rome, and he was one of the few priests in our area that could be ordained a bishop, and he knew all the ologies there are to know, except he didn't know a thing about alcoholism. But we believed him, or we hoped. We still had hope. So we decided we would try it. So he said he would get Bill to sign a pledge. And so we moved into this little house. And Bill signed the pledge. And everything was going to be lovely. And it was for 29 days. I can't say it was lovely either, because it wasn't. Any of you who have lived with an alcoholic, sober, without benefit of the program, know what I mean when I say that I was not sorry when he took that drink, because he was as miserable to live with sober, more so, than he was drunk, or I was as miserable, because I didn't have anybody to blame all these silly things on now. He was sober, and I couldn't blame this and that and something else on him. And as he says, he would have made Carrie Nation a perfect husband because he wanted to chop down saloons and all this kind of stuff, and he was picking on it. Ordinarily, Bill was a quiet drunk, always. Any time that there was any arguments, it was always my fault. If I'd left him alone, he'd have been nice and quiet. But I had to tell him all these things he was doing wrong. How else would he know? And but anyway, forgot where I was. Father, when I called Father Lehman then to tell him that Bill had broken his pledge and that this was going to be it, that I was going to leave him once and for all, why, he threw up both hands and he didn't know which way to turn. And he came over to the house and he said, "Well, the only thing I can tell you is that you had better get away from him. You had better leave him because he's going to kill you and this child both, not physically, but mentally." And I said, "Well, I'm not only going to leave him, I'm going to get a divorce." And so he said, "Oh, no, you can't get a divorce. You're a Catholic. You can't get a divorce." And I said, "I am getting a divorce. This, my religion hasn't offered me a thing. Here I ran to church every day, and I always sat on the front row where he could see me." And I told him, I said, "You see me there. You see me at church. You see me, what kind of a housekeeper I am, what kind of a wife I am, what kind of a mother I am. I've done everything, and God has let me down. So I don't care whether I can still be a Catholic or not. I'm getting a divorce." So finally he said, "Well, I'll give you permission to get a divorce, but remember this, you can never remarry." And I thought, oh, gee whiz, the whole family's crazy. This was the farthest thing from my mind. If I ever get out of this mess, I'll never get back into it again. So we divorced, and anyone who is thinking about it, anyone new or anyone living with a problem, the only thing I can tell you is it didn't solve a thing. I only exchanged one set of problems for another because I worried about him. I worried more about him away from him than I did when I was with him. Of course, I went back home to Mother again, and he would come down to see our son, and he would be dirty and unshaven. No clothes. He'd have on the same old pair of trousers and the same old dirty shirt week after week. And I would, when he would stagger back up the street, I would stand in the doorway and cry. And my mother couldn't understand this. She thought I was really crazy. She'd say, "What on earth are you wasting tears on him for? He doesn't love you. If he loved you, he'd stay home. He'd take care of you. He'd stay sober. He'd take care of you and this child." And I thought this too. I believed this. But yet, there was something there. I knew down deep what kind of a person he was sober. I still was hanging on to that thread of hope. I'm sure I was. But after many, many, many weeks of this, and on occasion I'd talk to him when he'd come in, but most of the time I wouldn't. I'd make myself scarce because we'd always end up in an argument. And so I'd usually make myself scarce, but I wanted to see him, to see what kind of a condition he was in. And when we were living together, I knew that he had clean clothes to wear if he wanted them, and I knew he had food if he was hungry, and I knew he had medical attention. But now I didn't. So I really worried more about him than I did when we were living together, and through the drinking bouts, they were not as bad as the worry that I had about him night after night away from him. So I didn't solve a thing. But we were divorced about a year when Bill came into AA. And he came down to tell me about it, and I was thrilled. I was happy that he had found something that might keep him sober, but I didn't believe him. I thought, well, he's not working, he's lost his job, and he doesn't have any money, and he was always getting $1 or $2 or $5 from me, and I thought, well, just wait until he goes back to work and draws a full pay. Then he'll get drunk again. And so I think, too, about this time, one of the things that amazed me was after 2 or 3 weeks of this, he wasn't asking me for money anymore, and he hadn't gone back to work either. And this sort of surprised me, or made me think, anyway. And so finally, he asked me to go to a meeting with him. And I wanted to, and I didn't want to. And I finally mentioned it to Mother, and she said, "Oh, my goodness, please don't be seen going in or out of a place like that." She said, "You've brought enough disgrace on us by getting a divorce. Now, please don't disgrace us anymore." So I'm curious by nature, and so I sneaked out like a 16-year-old on their first date and went to my first AA meeting with Bill. And I was surprised and very much impressed. And I just couldn't believe what I saw. And so, but I didn't go too often with him. I think, in fact, I was afraid to. I knew that if anything happened, that if I did go back with him, and anything did happen, that I would not be welcome back home with Mother again. I knew that this was it, that since I was clear and free of this mess, that if I got myself back into it again, that I wouldn't be welcome back home with Mother. And I was pretty sure I couldn't make it on my own again. So I was rather skeptical. But you know how these AA boys work. And they were calling me and asking me to go to meetings with Bill and to do this and to do that. So I finally just went with him on several occasions. And come time for him to get his token after 1 year of sobriety. And I went with him this night. I was more so, a very shy person. At this time, I didn't mix with people at all. You leave me alone, and I'll leave you alone. And on the few times that I went to meetings with him, I would stand back in the corner, and if you walked up to me and said hi in a very certain manner, I might say hi back to you, and I might not. But if you didn't look just right, then I wasn't going to answer you back. And so Bill is a very outgoing person. He mixes well, and he fell in love with the program immediately and made all kinds of friends. And so I was sort of left out. And like I've been reminded of it several times down here, he's been here two or three times, and this is my first time. And every once in a while, he'll look around, and he'll say, oh, that's right, you haven't been here before. You know, someone else will come up and introduce me to somebody else. And he walks off and leaves me standing. And this is what happened at this time. And I resented it then. But the night he got his token, everybody was so proud of him, and they were patting him on the back and telling him what a wonderful job he was doing. And they'd walk up to me, and they would smile, and they'd say, aren't you proud of him? And I would stand there with my benevolent smile, and I'd say, yes, I'm proud of him. And inside I was saying, hell no, I'm not proud of him. Why should I be? He's only done 1 year what I've been doing all my life. And what he should have been doing all his life. So what was to be so proud? I hadn't accepted this as a disease, and this was extremely hard for me. This was one of the most difficult things I've ever tried, is to accept this as a disease. But anyway, took a couple more years for us to decide to go back together. Bill says he doesn't know which one was the glutton for punishment. But we were divorced 4 years, and he was in AA 3 years when we remarried. And I think when I would hear men, there weren't too many women in the program at this time, and when I would hear men tell their story and tell how they had suffered and what hell they had gone through, I would just sit there and shake, and I would think, they've gone through hell. What about the poor wife? What about the poor family? They chose this way, but we were a victim of circumstances. We were the ones that suffered. I couldn't see how they could stand up there and say they had suffered so much. So, and the 12 steps, I had heard them many times, and I thought they were wonderful for him. Boy, he needed every one of them. An additional 12 on top of that 12 I could add to it. But I think when I decided to remarry him, that it said somewhere in his 12 steps where he had to make amends. And to whom did he owe amends? To me and our son. That was the limit. So I was going to give him a chance to work his program. So we remarried, and I thought things were going to be lovely. I thought he will work his program. I wanted him in AA. Don't misunderstand me. I loved AA for him, and I wanted him in the program, but I wanted him to work it my way. I had managed to do everything all my life my way, and I was going to get him to work his program my way. So I set out to do this. And when we first remarried, we moved into this little house, and things were just going to work out perfectly. I knew they were, because he was going to come home from work and help me. I was still working, too, by this time. I hadn't gotten to the point where I could quit work yet, or where I thought I could quit work yet. And I resented this. I always resented working, and I still do. This is one of my big resentments I work on every day. But I have learned through the program that I'm not working for Bill or for anybody else. I'm working for me. I'm working to get the things that I want, not the things that he wants. So, but I felt like that this would be a whole new life again, and that he would come home from work and he would help me with the housework and he would do this and that. And instead of that, he was back in his same old pattern. He was the same old Bill. And he'd come home from work and he'd lie down on the couch and take his nap while I fixed dinner, and then he'd get ready and he'd go to a meeting, and while I did the dishes and helped Bill Jr. with his homework and all these things that a father's supposed to do, I was out transporting the kids all over town, and he was out running to AA meetings, and he would come home at night and we'd go to bed 11, 12 o'clock, and he'd be so tired, and about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning the phone would ring and he'd be off again. And I used to think, well, if he's so tired, how can he get up and run out all hours of the night? Why don't he stay in bed where he belongs? And I resented this. And the boys, they all, I've heard, you know, by the grapevine that they like sweet stuff and you're supposed to keep a lot of sweet stuff around the house. And, of course, I was a dutiful wife. I was still going to be that perfect wife. And I always had homemade pies and cakes. And you know how these boys love that. And they'd stop by on Saturdays, you know, for their coffee and cake. I'd serve it sweetly, you know, and they'd get sit around, talk for an hour or two, and they'd leave, and then poor old Bill would catch it. The grass needed cutting, the windows needed washing, and all this and all that, and this wasn't done. About that time, the phone would ring and be another 12-step call. So finally, I decided that I didn't like this kind of a life either, and I thought, well, I'll make him work his AA. I'll make him work it the way I want him to. So I decided one night, I told him when he came in, that I was going to leave him again. And I said, I am no better off now than I was when you were drinking. We don't have any more money. You're not home anymore. I'm left alone. And I thought that he would take me in his arms and say, oh, I'll do anything you want me to. Just please don't leave me. I'll do anyway. Whatever nights you want me to go, those are the nights I'll go. And I'll work it the way you want me to work it. And you know, he fooled me. He didn't. He said, I don't want you to leave, but if this is the way you want it, this is the way it'll have to be. You are not interfering with my AA. And this is another miracle in my part of the program, because with my determination and my stubbornness, it's a wonder I hadn't packed my little bag and went back home to Mother again. But I didn't. I stayed. And shortly after this, we attended the international conference at St. Louis, and there I heard about Al-Anon. Now, I didn't attend the Al-Anon workshop or the meeting. I heard about it. And there I met Lois and Bill. And I think here is where I had my first twinge of gratitude. I can remember them, Lois and Bill, walking out on the stage this night. And a lot of you have seen him, I'm sure. He's a big, tall, lanky thing, and she's a sweet, grandmotherly type person. And he led her by the hand out on this stage, and I looked around. There were some 5,000 people there, and I think I had my first twinge of gratitude. I thought about the lives that these two people had touched, but I still didn't think there was anything wrong with me. So we come back from this conference, and a couple of the men in the area bought the Al-Anon book. Now why, I don't know. But they brought it back, and I don't think it was cracked for a long time, and finally one of the men said, if you all aren't going to use this book, why don't we give it to a library or somewhere where it will do some good? So a couple of the gals said, well, maybe we better start an Al-Anon meeting. Well, Bill and I were, Bill was in AA longer than most of them in our area at that time, and I was still putting up my good front, you know, in front of people. And so they asked me if I would help them start the Al-Anon group. That we were such a happy, well-adjusted couple that they thought that I had so much to offer, and would I help them? And I thought, well, what have I got to lose? I'll help these poor kids if they think they need something like that. So I started going to Al-Anon, and I went religiously. Our meetings were on Wednesday night, and I don't think I missed a Wednesday night. But after so long a time, I began to doubt myself. I knew that the other people, the other gals there, were getting something out of the program that I wasn't. They had certain peace of mind and serenity that I didn't have. And I would hear different ones talk about, they'd say, oh, so-and-so's jealous of AA. If we could just get her in Al-Anon, I think it would help her. And then they'd set out to get this gal in Al-Anon. And they'd say, I don't see how in the world anybody can be jealous of AA. Do you? And I'd say, no, I don't. And here I was. And if somebody told me there was a jealous bone in my body, I would have called them a liar. But I was jealous of AA. And this is what I had prayed for. This is what I had prayed for all my life. I had run to church every time the church bell rang for Bill to sober up. And I couldn't see this. I couldn't see that this was the answer to my prayers. I was still resented these people whom he hardly knew that come along and took him by the hand. He stayed sober for them, but he couldn't stay sober for me. He loved his bottle when he was drinking more than he did me, and now he loved these people more than he did me, and I couldn't stand this. But anyway, I continued to go. The miracle continues on, because one of the other gals in our program had a car, and so did I, and we would drive, pick up the people, the other gals around the area. We'd drive for 20 and 25 miles picking up other people to take them to the meeting. And every time, every so often, I was going to quit. And every time I quit, her car broke down. Every Wednesday night that I wasn't going back, I'd get that telephone call that something or somebody wanted to borrow her car or something, and I'd have to go. So finally, another miracle, we attended the Southeastern Conference in Biloxi, Mississippi. And you know how I felt about AA and about Al-Anon, too. And there was another couple we ran around with, and she didn't even go to Al-Anon. But the four of us had planned to go to Biloxi. And it so happened that my husband changed jobs in the meantime. He couldn't get his vacation. The other man was an attorney, and he had an important case coming up, and he couldn't go away. And this gal and I took off for Biloxi alone to the conference. And there I met Lois. And I can't describe the feelings that I have for her. I can't begin to. I heard her in her story tell about throwing her shoe at Bill when they were preparing to go to a dinner party, and he come in and told her that he couldn't go, that he had to go on a 12-step call, and she threw her shoe at him. And I was able to identify with her. I thought anyone as sweet and lovely, and I even feel sacrilegious when I talk about her now. And I thought, if she could act that way or react that way, then I wasn't all bad. There was still some hope for me, and I was able to identify with her. And this is why I tell my story in the manner I do. If I'm able to help one person as I have been helped, then it's worth it. And I was able to identify with Lois. We had Ruth and Bish, who most of you know, had a brunch at their home for Lois, and I had the opportunity of spending quite a lot of time with her. And I told her about how I felt about Al-Anon and how I wasn't getting out of it what I thought other people were. And she told me, she said, first, get yourself a sponsor. She said, someone in whom you can trust, someone that you can talk to and tell them anything. No matter how silly it sounds, how terrible it sounds to you, you might think it sounds, talk to her. Tell her, him or her, whomever it may be. Whatever is on your mind, talk. You aren't getting this out of your system. And I realize that now. I didn't want anybody to know the real me. I didn't want anybody to know me. So I got myself a sponsor, and I began telling her all these things that I didn't want people to know about me. And a lot of times when I would leave her at night, I would swear up and down I'd never speak to her again, because she would tell me some things I certainly didn't want to hear. But she was right most of the time. And she also told me to get in here and work the program. She said, whatever you're asked to do, do not refuse. And this is something else, that I came back with a new determination that I was going to work the program. And since that day, I have never refused. I have worked the program to the best of my ability. I may not have always worked it well, but I have worked it to the best of my ability. She also told me that I had to get honest with myself. As I told you, I didn't think I was jealous. I didn't think I was envious. I didn't think I was dishonest. I thought I was perfect. And to get honest with myself, how could some honest person get honest with themselves? And this I found was so true, that I do have to be honest with myself. She also told me I had to learn to forgive myself. How can you ask God to forgive you if you can't forgive yourself? She also told me I had to learn to love myself. And how can you be lovable if you don't love yourself. And I found so many things that I talked to her a good half an hour or 45 minutes, and I can't begin to tell you how I feel or what I got out of that little half an hour. It has just opened up a whole new world for me. She told me that I could only change me. And this is so true. All these years, I had been trying to change Bill. And I've learned since then that I don't even want to change Bill. That I married Bill because he was Bill. And I love Bill because he is Bill. And if I changed him, he wouldn't be Bill. He'd be someone else. And 9 chances out of 10, when you change a person, you're trying to change them into what you want them to be or into what you think you are. And I know if I changed Bill into me that we wouldn't get along 2 minutes. So every morning, now, I look in the mirror and I ask myself, what kind of a person are you going to be to live with today? Are you going to be difficult or are you going to be easy? I don't always choose to be easy, but at least I am aware of my meanness and my little nasty traits. I also learned that I have to make amends to God first, because I was blaming God for being in the spot that I was in. I resented all this. I thought he wasn't a loving God. He wasn't a just God. And I didn't understand my God until I came into Al-Anon, until I began to really work the program. I also know that I have to make amends to Bill. I expected him to make so many amends to me, and I realize now that I owe him more amends than he would ever owe me, because the things he did were the results of an illness. And the things I did, I was aware of them. I was doing them for meanness and revenge and resentment and all this. I turned our son against him. I was the one that told our son he had a no good father, and that if he could have all the things he wanted if he had a decent father. And I was the one that when our son would come to me for something, and I would be so beside myself, so filled with my own inner thoughts, that I wouldn't give him an answer. Many times the child has come to me and asked if he could go somewhere, and I'd say yes, and maybe a couple hours later I'd have no idea where he was. I'd be so filled with my own thoughts I wouldn't even know where he asked me. I'd just give him an answer, and this was it. I turned his own family against him. I turned his friends against him. So I owe more amends to Bill than I do to anyone else. I've also learned to live one day at a time, and this has meant just measures to me. I can't tell you. I was one that always lived in the years. As I told you, I had already put our son through college when he was only 3 years old. He's 34 years old now, and he still hasn't gone to college. We still couldn't afford to send him to college if he wanted to go. So the program is just, I can't tell you the gratitude in my heart for you people. I think my Thanksgiving prayer this week would be to thank God, first of all, for Lois and Bill, for the people, the pioneers in this wonderful AA and Al-Anon program. Secondly, to you people who have taken me by the hand and led me along the way. And last but not least, to my husband, because if it were not for my alcoholic husband, I wouldn't have the opportunity to share this wonderful, beautiful, lovely program with you all. Thank you.